I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Bonnie Honig, Nancy Duke Lewis Professor in the Departments of Modern Culture and Media and Political Science at Brown University. We're discussing her 2017 book, Public Things, Democracy and Disrepair, from Fordham University Press. Honig works on contemporary liberal and democratic theory and the history of political thought. She is the author of Political Theory and the Displacement of Politics, Democracy and the Foreigner, Emergency Politics, Paradox Law, Democracy, Antigone Interrupted, as well as numerous co-edited volumes and articles. You say, first of all, Bonnie Honig, thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the book is called Public Things, and it's about public things. The book is really interesting intervention in democratic theory, in part because, at least as I understand it, a lot of democratic theory heretofore is sort of focused on procedural elements in understanding the nature of the public, but less attention has been paid to the actual thing side. There's been more attention to the public side, but less attention to the thing side. And you really, I think, do a nice job in redressing that gap there in the discussion. So thank you for that. Let me ask you, first of all, what motivated you to write this book and talk about this topic?
Okay. So I think what motivated me to write the book was a sense that all the really good work in democratic theory was leaving out one thing that was centrally important, and that was the importance of public things to democratic imagination and democratic practice. So I have an argument, for example, in the first lecture with Wendy Brown, whose book I really admire. It's called Undoing the Demos. And the argument there is about how people have become kind of trained into neoliberal rationality and entrepreneurial styles of thinking, and that this will be the undoing of the possibility of democracy. And I agree with a lot of what she says, but the one thing that doesn't come up not only in her work, but in other people's work as well, that I thought was an important added consideration, was the practices of privatization and neoliberalization, the effects that those things have on our stewardship. In other words, on removing from the scene the objects around which we constellate as a democratic community and that require our care, and that themselves might even have the power to interpolate us into democratic citizenship. In other words, they call to us when they fail, they call to us when they succeed in different kinds of ways. And that was an insight that I learned from reading the work of Jane Bennett and others on vibrant and vital materialism and object-oriented ontology. Those are very different approaches, but all of them try to give us a sense of the importance of objects and things to life, and then from there it's just one step to starting to think about the importance of public objects or public things to democratic life in particular.
That's great. So maybe we could get into what you actually mean by public things. I think that's a good place to start. It's the title after all. So maybe you could start by saying a bit about what you mean in general, and then kind of giving us an example or two to illustrate it.
I go out of my way to say that I don't want to give a definition of public things, partly because definitions sort of set the reader up right away to start to quarrel with them. At least that's how I receive them. So instead, I proceed in a way that's a little bit more Wittgensteinian, and I just offer a lot of examples and explain why, in relationship to each example, you know, there's a reason to think about it in terms of its publicness and thingness. And there are, as I say, a lot of examples. I think that the very first one that comes up might be the Mercier Bridge in Quebec, which joins a part of Quebec called Kahnawake with Montreal, which is an island. And that bridge was built, I think, in the early 20th century by steel workers and iron workers who were members of the Mohawk tribe and who had great expertise in that. And it was also designed by French engineers who created the plans. And the bridge has come in the middle to late 20th century since Quebec went further along the road of decolonization in the 70s to create more equality between French and English in that province, the bridge has come to represent to the French side, you know, a kind of testament to French education and ingenuity and expertise. At the same time, on the Indigenous side, it represents the, you know, wonderful contributions of Indigenous people as well. And so, but these obviously come into conflict sometimes. The Mercier Bridge was occupied by members of the Mohawk tribe in 1993 as part of a protest against a Quebecois efforts to appropriate sacred land for a nine-hole golf course. The sacred land is also a public thing. I'm not sure if that nine-hole golf course was going to be a public course or a private one, but in a way it was also going to be a public thing. And it instantiated in those two visions a conflict that is there in the single thing of the Mercier Bridge, which is Indigenous memories of that bridge, French memories of that bridge, are constellated around a common object, and yet we're talking about this in the context of a settler colonial society in which equality between Indigenous people and settlers has still not yet been achieved. And so that inequality is remembered by the bridge, as is the aspiration for equality, as are the multiple talents and contributions of everyone to the public thing at the same time. So it's a bit of a complicated mess, and that is the way it often is with public things. Yeah, so the Mercier Bridge is the first example, but there are many others, and they include all kinds of things like schools and roads and bridges, but also things like sewage treatment plants and prisons, and that's because I didn't want to just have nice public things and make the argument easier. Public things include sewage treatment and prisons, in which even if we are a part of the abolitionist movement, let's say, or the anti-incarceration movement, our tax dollars and our citizenship or membership means that we're implicated in these practices. So a lot of what goes on in our name and constitutes us as members of a public or a shared citizenship of some sort is not just pretty. Even the bridges and the dams and other things that we may be prouder of, another example is Central Park, but all of those are also now available to be seen as more problematic because we're a little more tuned into the ways in which they have effects on the natural environment that may have been deleterious. And, for example, right now, there's a very big movement to take down many of the dams that were built in the middle of the last century, and they've been quite successful until recently. I don't actually know how they're doing right now under the current administration. But a lot of dams that were built in the middle of the century up through the 70s have been reconsidered and some of them taken down because of an awareness that those public things have had deleterious effects on the lives of fish, on the environment, and also on Indigenous life itself.
Yeah, I sort of appreciated the last point of the sewage treatment plants point too. I mean, I live in Houston. I've lived here about 10 years. And yeah, there's often an emphasis on the beauty of public things. Although in Houston, there's a lot of ugly public things. So a lot of roads, a lot of concrete. But in some ways, this is a sort of, as you say, it's a characteristically, these are characteristically public things, although many of the roads are becoming privatized. So there is that. But it's sort of constitutive in a deep way of who Houstonians are and how we think about ourselves. For good and for ill, some people loathe all the concrete, and some people find it liberating.
Yeah, so I haven't been to Houston lately, and I don't know what the concrete is looking like there these days or the asphalt, but I do know from having written a foreword for a book that's coming out any day called, what was it called, America Reconsidered? That book has photographs in it of projects done under the Recovery Act, under late Bush and then Obama, and compares them to projects that were done under the WPA earlier, that were much more, as you can see from the photographs in that book, of America Recovered. The earlier ones in the 20th century were much more grand, and their construction, much of it out of concrete and steel, the big dams, the Hoover Dam and the others of the period, are not just functional, interestingly. They're also very beautiful. They're architecturally designed to be have symmetry and to have a kind of monumentalism that is not just about the function of stopping and letting water flow, but is also about communicating to citizens, you know, what it means to be part of something shared. Like, no one person could build a thing like that all by themselves. That's kind of the point, and that it's a nationalizing device, and potentially a democratizing device. So even though we rethink what we think about dams now, some of us who are more environmentally inclined perhaps, there's something about that earlier time of building things that were for the public, and that were proudly made public, that is important to recall now and perhaps to be reinfused by, much like Central Park, which is another one of my examples in New York City. There's one more thing about those dams. What was I going to say? That they were very aware of this architectural beauty and their aesthetic powers, because you could take tours of them. In other words, they weren't just functional, hidden away, and they did the job of stopping and starting water flows. People, there are pictures in the book of people showing up at these dams, you know, waiting to take a tour. So there was some civic function that they performed at the symbolic or level or the level of political culture that was on top of their use function, which I think is quite interesting and remains a possibility for us with maybe different kinds of public things than those.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was thinking about. You know, a lot of your examples are sort of the post-war period. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me is that the sort of theories of architecture have embedded with them a kind of, as you say, a sort of civic understanding. One of the purposes of the art of architecture is a democratic one. I mean, I seem to remember sort of like John Dewey talking about architecture at various places. In part, maybe this is a book that speaks to those who are architects or to develop, you know, it has implications for a kind of architectural theory or theory of the construction of public spaces.
That's a great point, which I had not thought of, and I think it's right. I mean, as you were saying that, I was thinking about the change in sort of public relations to architecture, and I just jotted down, you know, well, now we have HGTV, right, where everybody's wanting an open concept.
Right.
Whereas my book writes about the importance of having a holding environment, which is precisely a walled-in space, not an open concept space. I think, but mostly what you have on HGTV, wouldn't that be interesting, actually, if there was a series about building public spaces rather than renovating private homes or finding vacation places to go to that are architecturally distinctive in some way. So the civic purpose of architecture, what I want to say is that architecture had a civic purpose, as you say. I think it still does. There are certainly people working within that field who are interested in building communities that are less dependent on private transportation, that are more positioned to either walk or use public transportation to get to their workplaces and schools. So there are movements like that, and I think actually the guy I end with in my book, Hans Monderman, who's a traffic engineer, is also an example of someone who's got a very sort of civic-minded orientation to the work he does, where he wants to change how people design streets and street signage so that those things are less oriented to a kind of the dangerousness of the car and the need to insulate pedestrians from cars, and more more oriented to understanding the public space of walking and driving and cycling as shared space that has to be designed in order to encourage everyone to understand the space as shared, where no single member has a right of way that's that can't be beaten out by anybody else. You know, that kind of competitive way of thinking about who's going to own the street is something that he's very much against. So he's an example of someone, it's not architecture of buildings, but architecture of public space through traffic engineering, who is keeping this idea of civic purpose, I think, or was, because he died prematurely, was keeping that idea of civic purpose and practice very much in mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think this speaks exactly to your thesis because, at least again, thinking about Houston, one of the difficulties of for architects whom I know who have a belief in the civic function of architecture is it's difficult to effectuate that, say, to have a kind of create a mixed use unit where you have just not living spaces, but also common areas and common sort of businesses that a lot of customers want simply to be removed, to be isolated, right? To just have an enormous apartment right. complex. And so that, you know, that in a way that the sort of, I guess you could say the relaxing of regulation that you certainly see in Houston where there's no zoning, so it cuts against mm-hmm. any kind of, some of these voices say in the sort of the civic nature of architecture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that Mondermann does is point to the importance of design in providing points of orientation for us. So if you could build a building that had some of these mixed-use properties, people might find, you know, that they enjoy them, right? If you build it, they might come, right? And at the same time, I think probably what cuts against that are more narrow rather than public calculations of profitability, because, of course, for every shared space, you know, you could have a recreation room or you could have yet one more apartment that you could rent or sell.
Right.
So if you're not renting or selling that space, presumably an economist would say the prices of all the other apartments have to go up in order to compensate you. But if people are willing to pay more in order to have that public space, then you would be able to have it, or that shared space, you would be able to have it. And as you say, most people would prefer to have an extra few square feet in their apartment rather than do it the other way. So that may be true in Houston, but I will say that I'm aware of some buildings in Los Angeles that cater to a kind of younger, maybe more entrepreneurial clientele, where the idea of shared space is very, very much touted. In other words, these are apartment buildings that are more almost like transitions from college dorms to private homes for people who are younger entrepreneurs. That's their preferred clientele. And people are willing to have smaller, I would say very expensive apartments in return for having a game room and a pool and an outside barbecue space and all of that stuff. So maybe in different places it's different. I'm not sure that's a product of zoning, though. I'm quite sure that's a product of what's profitable to sell in Santa Monica versus what might be profitable to sell in Houston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
I think your point about zoning is very important, because that's, of course, how a local community exerts some control over its development and can be guided by an anti-growth or moderate growth or unimpeded growth kind of orientation, depending on who's been elected and what the power of the different parties and constituents is in that area.
Right. And one of the effects, I hate to go on about Houston, but it's relevant case study for me here, but one of the effects is that it's hard to find a common public space. We've been talking a fair bit about infrastructure, but you also talk about public spaces, public parks where people can gather politically. And I mean, there are a few places here and there in Houston, but one of the effects of no zoning is that it's just a sprawl. It's a sprawl in all four directions, really, north, south, east, and west. So it makes it, I mean, there are, Houston does have parks and it does have an upkeep of public spaces, but there isn't a clear, you know, if you have a say an Occupy Wall Street in Houston, there isn't a clear place where it would be. Do you have a general view?
Often, as you might know from university campuses, the ones that were built after the 1960s are built without the kinds of public spaces that the earlier ones had, precisely in order to prevent future occupations of the administrative buildings. Mm-hmm. If you look around the country, there are several universities with post-60s construction where the administrative parts of the campus look kind of like a bunker. And it's sometimes hard to find the door.
Wow.
And that's not, talk about architecture for civic purposes.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily the civic purpose we would want, but that is there's an architectural style for those administrative buildings that's very much purposive in a way, in order to undo the possibilities of a certain kind of protest occupying the administrative building. I should say also that I don't want to romanticize too much common space without also saying I do want to romanticize it a lot with you. And at the same time, I want to point out that where it exists, it's often policed. And when it exists and is policed, it's often policed asymmetrically, which is to say, people who aren't white, people who are wearing hoodies, people who somehow look to some, shopping mall guard like they don't belong, are intervened with, interrupted, interrogated, and sometimes removed from those spaces. So having these spaces is really important, but as soon as we have them, the question of how they can be claimed and by whom and who gets to occupy them is right on its heels.
Right, and you also make the interesting point, which I was struck by, is that when those public spaces are democratized or made more inclusive, then the response often of the rich, say, is to opt out or is to leave or abandon the public spaces, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the examples that I talk about in the book is the example of public swimming pools, and the idea there is to suggest, along with, I think it's Brittany Cooper's work that I draw on there, it's to suggest that there's, maybe not an intentional, but maybe an intentional, but certainly a contingent kind of partnership between what we think of as neoliberalization, which is always looking to privatize, and the sort of defense and maintenance of structures of white supremacy. So in this case, which illustrates that partnership, whether it's intentional or contingent, swimming pools and other kinds of public things like them, parks and schools, were highly valued parts of American society until the 1950s, when the first movements towards integration were successful. And as African Americans won the right to share public swimming pools and public schools and public parks, suddenly, as if by, coincidence, all of a sudden developers were building not just for the rich, but for the middle class, homes in the suburbs that had swimming pools in their backyards. And so instead of having neighborhood pools where people gathered and met with each other and their neighbors, but where everyone now had a right to be, suddenly, it was part of the American dream to have a house and a pool. And, that innovation is not unconnected to the fact that the pools that were available had suddenly become a different kind of space in which, others, strangers, racial minorities, were as legally welcome as white people. And so there was a kind of withdrawal, which, we know about the flight from the city, but it comes, you can see the importance of race to the desire to be isolated that you described earlier with reference to the apartments in Houston. You can see that desire to be isolated as not unconnected to a kind of fraughtness that happens to public things as the move to racial equality is strengthened and enabled in the 1960s to some extent.
Good. Yeah, so this is a last question about the nature of public things. We've been talking about examples of infrastructure, of public spaces. We mentioned Education, universities especially, are one of your examples that you use. I was trying to think of other examples of public things that maybe you didn't mention that I wanted to ask you about. And one thing that came to mind was, I guess you could say broadly, the basket of public things that are what you might call public symbols, like monuments or flags. Mm-hmm. Especially monuments have become very much in the news, one could say, recently. What do you make of, characterize those public symbols and monuments as common things? And how do you think about sort of current controversies about that issue?
I didn't write about this in the book, partly because the book in some ways predates, but is right on the cusp of these very public arguments about our monuments in the U.S. But I have a view. It's perhaps not as well considered as things that I write because I haven't thought it through. But I am partial to the idea that some of the contested monuments, that it would be a good idea to put them, to remove them from the spaces that they're in now, where they function as a kind of, as an ongoing device of marginalization, where people walk by, figures who are well known for white supremacist views, or for, in the case of that New York statue, experimenting gynecologically on black women. I can't remember the person's name. That statue was taken down, I believe. I think it would be great to put them into a museum of relics, mm-hmm. and to have them there to commemorate for people who want to go to them, where we've been and where we are and where we continue to struggle. In other words, removing them in order to erase them is probably a less good idea than putting them themselves on display. So I guess a way of saying that in terms of the arguments of the book is to say that these objects, these statuary and these monuments, when they're outside, they all have a history. And a lot of them are put up particularly in moments of desegregation. Like, why is there a statue of someone who's known for their segregationist views in this public park? Look up the history, and you will find that very often it's erected in response to not the Civil War itself, but 20 years later under Jim Crow, that suddenly these statues are going up. Their purpose is to police behavior in the public sphere, to kind of create an overlife for the segregationist actor sometimes. And so sort of removing them from that place, but holding on to them and putting notes of explanation about their histories and when they were put up and all of that sort of creates a kind of critical relationship to them, so that they're less interpolating us into a space of inequality and become themselves objects of critical scrutiny, of historiography and public memory.
Yeah, I mean, do they still count as public things on your view? I mean, this gets into an interesting issue, because if they're erected by one group for the subjugation of another group, they're not public in that sense. They're sort of a power play to subjugate one or the other.
Yeah, true. I mean, I think I want to say, I don't want to say they're not public things, because although you're correct, they're put up by a part of a citizenry in a hegemonic move to marginalize another part. And at the same time, they're maintained and cleaned and tended to, and the grass around them is mowed using tax dollars that all of us are paying. And I don't want to disallow the idea that those who want them taken down are those who are part of the public who own them, in a way, right? So I kind of want to hold on to the part where they're public enough that we all have a say in what happens to them, rather than saying, well, they're not really public and that's why they should be taken down. They're kind of both. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, their purpose is to partition the public so that only a part stands for the whole, which is an offense against democratic equality. But at the same time, all of us are interpolated by them into that effort. And in that sense, we all have a say in what happens to them.
Yeah, I mean, maybe to put it in a different way and in the form of a question, one of the things I was thinking about in this context and thinking about your view of public things is I was wondering what, if you have a normative view of it, if there are good and bad public things. And I guess one of the things that which I just asked you about was the intention behind the creation of public things as a way to assess it. But I guess one also might think of the effect of public things. That is, that do they enable or disable democratic citizenship? I mean, it seems like on your view, that's something of normative salience, right? If a public thing enables citizenship, even if it's sort of people are conflicted about what it means, that's good. But if it sort of enables one group and you know, marginalizes another group, then it's bad.
Right. So, yes. And I think both of those things are true at the same time. So if you think of Bree Newsom climbing up to remove the flag of the Confederacy from, was it South Carolina, the South Carolina State House? Is that where she did that a few years ago? So that was an act of agonistic citizenship. You know, where she understood the flag flying to be claiming to represent her or to erase her, and she, through an act of civil disobedience, insisted on the objection to it as itself a way of creating and guarding an inequality among citizens rather than interpolating us equally into a public. I think the problem with public things is that, you know, they interpolate us equally into sometimes an unequal public and therefore call for, you know, to be maintained or to be taken down accordingly. The principle, the normative principle, the only one that matters to me is democratic equality. And if the thing is there in order to guard a division of the people into black or white or newcomer immigrant versus old established citizen or whatever it is, then that calls for either action or interrogation. It's not, you know, in different cases we might decide things differently, but of course that call issues from that thing. And insofar as that call is available to many of us to hear, even though the function of the thing is its division of the people, its call to either be interfered with or to be supported and maintained in opposition to others who want to take it down is one that can be heard across the public. So it's kind of a subtle point. I mean, even as I'm explaining it, it seems like I'm insisting on a very small thing. You know, the Confederate flag, obviously, to go to the example and maybe to make it more concrete, obviously stands for a division of people into different publics or into a public and a private or whatever it is. It stands for division. But at the same time, in flying over the State House, it addresses even those it tends to demean, and they can be responsive to it, and in that sense, it helps to fold them in, paradoxically, to the very public that it wants to deny.
Yeah, good. That's really helpful. So we've been talking about, I think, a lot of the issues that comprise the first lecture in the book, which you entitled Democracy's Necessary Conditions, which makes a case for the importance of public things, but also talks about, when I say, the fragility of public things, that the many ways in which they can be subverted or eroded in democratic life. I thought maybe if you'd like to sort of expand on that point, I think the central example, which I found very helpful in the lecture, was the confrontation between the Native American tribe that you discuss and the oil and gas company, I think it was Chevron, to put a pipeline through their land, and the discussion that ensued there. So feel free to discuss I found it an interesting story.
So that we're talking now about the Unist'ot'en camp in British Columbia.
Right.
And the ongoing, since I wrote the book, efforts of Chevron and other oil and gas companies to build pipelines across Native lands. For me, I don't know what struck you about the story. You can say. For me, one of the things that's quite striking about that story is that the tribe in question never, unlike most of the other tribes in North America, the tribe in question has never signed on to any kind of a treaty or agreement with the Canadian government, even one that recognizes their rights. They've just, in what a lot of people on the left would identify as a kind of Bartleby move, they just preferred not to, in a principled way. I think they knew what they were doing. As a result of this, it turns out that when other tribes have entered into agreements with the Canadian government, the rights that they gained are also part of an agreement, and therefore they exist in a kind of negotiable relationship over time. Whereas having never signed a treaty, this tribe has, the courts have recognized in Canada in over 150 cases, so you can see how hard they're being challenged, over 150 cases have repeatedly been found to have non-negotiable rights, simply because they never entered into the mutuality of a contractual relationship. Not simply for that reason, obviously they have historical rights, but I mean this is an important element of their claim, that they never entered into such an agreement. And but in terms of, you know, practical politics, holding on to their land, and the name of a short film about their efforts is called Holding Our Ground. It's very much about holding, which is an important term in this book. So it's clear that in order to hold their ground, they cannot just rely on courts, even courts that side with them hundreds of times. They have to build camps on their land for the express purpose of being there when the oil companies show up to make their maps and plant their flags and prepare the way for the pipeline to be built, which they continue to do. Originally, they try to come in by truck and by bus and van, and the tribe shuts down the roads, and then the oil company, of course, acquires helicopters, and they, you know, fly over the roads and try to land in the middle of the wilderness and do their work there, surveying the land and the rest, and the tribe, you know, has to chase them down and order them to leave. And so it's a constant kind of occupation to hold their ground. And this short film sort of describes and portrays some of what they do. And I have a bit of a reading of the film in which at one point some surveyors from the oil company show up, and they actually have the temerity to offer to these tribe members bottled water and cigarettes as a gift to show their goodwill as they, you know, try to come onto the land to build this pipeline. I say they have the temerity to do that because, of course, those are, you know, gifts that have a history to offer tobacco to Indigenous peoples. And they do it, you know, by the side of a clean river that's flowing gorgeously and offering, as one of the members of the tribe points out, lovely water to drink, and there's no need for the polluting plastic. So there's just something, you know, offensively historical about the particular gifts that are chosen in that one recorded scene, as if someone had written it as a movie, as if it wasn't, you know, real life. I think the important thing about that story, too, though, is that, like sewage treatment in prisons, those pipelines are public things, and they support, you know, the infrastructure of Canada, the provision of electricity, and the sale of energy also to the U.S., which then, provides more money to the coffers of the Canadian government, which then, you know, supports health care and other kinds of public things as well. And so it's, again, as with so many public things, a very fraught situation in which, particularly in this settler colonial context, you can see, you know, efforts to accumulate and dispossess in action. It's not like a historical thing that Marx is writing about from a couple hundred years ago. It's now. It's every day. And the idea that these things are over and that these ways of life and collective living and land-based living that are at odds with these appropriations are somehow gone and relics of a past, all of that is belied by these political activities that are going on there. And, of course, in the U.S. at Standing Rock, we saw the same sort of reminder that these are things that are very much still with us, these forms of life, these ideas, these values, and that they have their own appeal to publics and are trying to, you know, appeal to us as a larger public to join with their vision of how to live in a sustainable and not always accelerative way. So I think that's, so those are among democracy's necessary conditions, the idea that in order for the democracy to be reproduced and sustained, the natural world needs to be related to in a sustainable way as well.
Right. Yeah. So I was particularly struck by the part of the story that you mentioned. Also, I was struck by your point that which you just made a couple moments ago, that this was really a clash over claims to right, that both are pursuing public things, which I found to be interesting. I was waiting for the lesson of the story to be that the Native American tribe had it right, but the oil and gas company is also pursuing public things too. This sort of, you know, an infrastructure. This isn't, the pipelines aren't simply privately owned, right? I mean, it's a sort of public private partnership, which makes it public in that way. It made me wonder how to resolve some of these conflicts. If you know, as democratic citizens, there's a sort of tragic conflict between right and right. I mean, what kind of guidance do you think we can be gained in those kinds of conflicts?
So it's interesting. I think I don't, but I could see why you would think about it as a conflict of rights. Because I feel like as soon as we start talking about it in terms of rights, we're on the tragic road, right? Where both sides have a right, and how do we adjudicate it?
Yeah, no, sorry, just to clarify, I didn't mean rights in the Anglo-American sense. I guess I meant sort of right in the rest German,
yes,
Hegelian sense.
Yeah, something on their side. Yes,
yeah.
And so very good. And so I think, you know, what I want to do with the idea of public things is to create an orientation and an angle of vision through which we can maybe have a different assessment of certain conflicts that we might otherwise think of in terms of, well, what's more efficient, or who has a better claim, or whose side is the law on, or something like that, right? So the perspective of public things is, to my mind, a democratic perspective. And for that reason, I think it's good to sort of air it out. In this case, I don't think public things provides an answer in each and every case. It instead, what it does is it just kind of shapes the way we think about the question, opening up room possibly for different answers than we might come to otherwise. And so in the case of this particular clash, it would be, I think, easier for me anyway to say, well, the indigenous tribe is obviously right. The courts have sided with them hundreds of times. They are defending a public thing of theirs. And the other side is these, you know, oil and gas companies, and they're private and profiteering and done. You know, we know who's right. And, but I'm less interested in who's right than I am in thinking about how both of them represent in a way, a clash of public things, right? But what the indigenous tribe represents is not just their claim to their public thing, but a vision of how all of us should relate to public things sustainably. And on the other side, we have, you know, a kind of orientation to the need for the current constellation of the public in Canada, which is energy consuming and oriented toward consumerism and needs heat and oil and food and all the other things, you know, that the current political economy is built on. So even though there's some profiteering there, no doubt, there's also a kind of meeting of a need, and so at the same, but what it carries with it is not just the meeting of a need, but a form of life, And it's a form of life that's very dedicated to growth and consumption and to the reproduction of the way we are now, and to its further acceleration by way of extractivism. So really what you end up looking at are not a clash of two rights, however we understand them, but a clash of two goods. In other words, two forms of life, both of which have the capacity to be and already are public. And so from a public things perspective, part of what you're oriented to is not who's right, but how do you want to live? Who do we want to be?
Right, right. Yeah, and I found this whole chapter very helpful in thinking about thinking through how we can deliberate about these competing goods. And I also found it helpful in thinking about the threats to public things, particularly your emphasis is on the market and neoliberal ideology. One of the things I wanted to ask you before turning to the second lecture was, I guess, what your view of the state and its role in the erection and maintenance of public things is. I'm part of asked this because at some parts in the book you mentioned some libertarian thinkers. I sort of consider James Scott a sort of moving in that direction. That is a kind of skepticism about the state and state power. Where do your sympathies lie? Do you tend to be more sympathetic or skeptical of state power in developing and maintaining public things?
Well, I think the state is a public thing. And so it's the public thing par excellence. And it's the set of mechanisms and collection of energies and transactionalisms through which the taxes that we pay and the energies that we devote and the participatory practices that are involved are all constellated and distributed across our collectivities. That's an idealistic way of putting it, but that's part of what it means to have a state. That it is then becomes, I almost want to say inevitably, because in this, I think James Scott is right, hierarchical, divisive, and so on, because of course it involves policing and enforcement and, discretionary power and courts and, all of what's called the legitimate coercion that is allotted to it, which is often not legitimate, however. All of that's true as well. So I have, I think you're right to point out that there are a couple of featured roles in the book that are assigned to either libertarians or anarchists. It's partly because libertarians and anarchists are more likely to understand the importance of sort of daily activism and reenactment of privileges and rights and claims rather than ceding them to courts and states. And so they, in that way, are compatible with the more agonistic view that I'm developing in this book. But it's also because I think that, but I'm not one of them per se, because I think that the state itself is a set of institutions with enormous powers that democratic citizens should not give up on. I am using the book in a way to sort of claim that some left and right suspicion of the state, while well warranted in terms of how its powers are used now, should not be allowed to become a reflexive anti-statism, because wouldn't it be great if we could take hold of it? In other words, why just castigate this enormous repository of great power when you could also elect better people to work in it and press them, hold them accountable to distribute its powers in ways that you would approve of rather than feel marginalized by. So I don't want to give up on it.
Good. Yeah, so in the second lecture, you talk about two different accounts of the relationship between human beings and objects or things. One from the British psychologist D.W. Winnicott, and the other one from political theorist Hannah Arendt. I thought we could talk about each briefly. I don't know much about Winnicott, so I was happy to read more about him. Maybe you could say a little bit about what Winnicott's view, is it object relations, is object relations theory, and how you apply it then to democratic life?
Sure. So anyone who's ever had a favorite blanket as a child, or if your children have them, or if you read Calvin and Hobbes, where Calvin has this toy tiger Hobbes, who is his best friend, but who's imaginarily animated because he's a stuffed animal. If you have that kind of familiarity with any of those things, those are all called transitional objects, and they are named so by Winnicott, whose account of child development is pitched on the idea of object relations. And the point of object relations theory is to talk about how the baby, when it's born, is not an individual unit, as, you know, liberalism sometimes leads us to believe, but is in fact in many ways still attached to the mother or to the parent or the caregiver, Winnicott is careful to say. And the achievement of individuality or individuation over time happens over time through a series of transitional objects, like a favorite blanket, a favorite toy tiger, even a favorite book, but something to which the child becomes, I want to say, like hyperbolically attached, right? Too attached. And that attachment is healthy for Winnicott. It's not really too attached at all. That kind of over-attachment is appropriate. It's not a fetish unless you're 35 and you still have your blanket. But when you're 3 and you have that blanket, it's not a fetish. It's actually a healthy transitional object. Its purpose is to help how it functions psychologically for Winnicott is in two ways. One is it gives the infant who feels quite dispersed, in other words, whose internal emotional experience is not one of unity. You know, a child development literature will tell you that when a child first sees its own thumb, it doesn't know that it belongs to itself. It's a thumb, like floating in space. And eventually, through thumb sucking, it comes to understand that that's part. It acquires a more integrative self-understanding, where it understands its body to not just be a dispersed set of limbs, but actually to all be part of an integrated self. Similarly, emotionally, the kind of strong feelings that wash over a child and seem to assault it from outside, you know, are eventually experienced as part of a more integrated self-understanding, where, you know, one has more control over those emotions and understands them to be circling around a self rather than to be assaulting one from elsewhere. So object relations is a story, a psychological or a psychoanalytic story of how we come to understand ourselves as integrated selves. One way in which that happens is by experiencing other objects as integrated unities, a blanket, you know, that has boundaries, and mirroring those things, like, so coming to understand ourselves as unities by having a relationship to objects that are unities. That's one. The other part is that the object has a kind of permanence. And by that, Winnicott means the best example I can think of is this one, that it provides the capacity to transition from one state to another. So a baby that has a blanket, let's say in Winnicott's story, and is very attached to its mother at a certain age, can more easily survive the absence of the mother, who may leave for a period of time to go to work, to go cook a meal, to visit a neighbor, and then return. When the mother leaves, the infant, who has no understanding of time or permanence, can feel abandoned. And infants that have transitional objects like a favorite blanket are better able to acquire and to experience the resilience that enables them to survive that absence, as if they had, but they don't yet, the confidence to know that the mother will return. So the object sort of creates a bridge, a transition from the mother's absence to the mother's return. So the argument, and this has to do ultimately not with only with the object, but that's why it's called object relations, with the capacity of the infant to relate to the object, to develop a relationship to the object that is both mirroring, giving the infant a unity it doesn't have for itself yet, and also bridging, through time, getting the infant from T1 to T2, where those two time points are divided by the absence of the mother or the caregiver. So what we see from Winnicott is how objects, which are destructible after all, but have a kind of relative permanence, is Arendt's term for that, show an infant, and I think later public objects, public things can show citizens, how to survive the bad times of abandonment and also to offer them a model of unity, of a kind of being bounded, that the collectivity, just like the infant, may not quite be able to provide for itself.
Yeah, I found this account really interesting in part because I've done work on Hegel. I know you've done work on Hegel. And I thought in this context of the early bits in the self-consciousness section where Hegel talks about the limits of objects or things in nature, that one of the problems with the natural things in the life, in the condition of life, is that they're precisely consumed by us and impermanent, that they don't reflect our subjectivity back to us, that we actually need other people, and that's the recognition of other people that provides it. This sort of turns it around. I mean, Winnicott's view turns it around, that it's actually the recognition of other people that's the fragile or unstable thing, and it's the object that provides the permanence.
Yes, that's a great way to put it, actually. But it's also not necessarily per se in either Winnicott or Arendt, natural things, which right. are subject to decay, but rather made or fabricated things like blankets or tables or chairs or rooms, those kinds of things, that have a kind of, like Arendt says, relative permanence. They will decay over time, but not like a leaf on the ground in a couple of days. Like, you know, she says, if we don't actively go out of our way to destroy these things, they will last a very long time before they finally give way to the deterioration of nature. And that's what makes them different from the natural objects that that Hegel thinks don't provide us with permanence at all. But you're quite right that the thing to which Hegel looks to provide that sense of permanence, which is other people, Winnicott, because of the work that he does in psychoanalysis, knows, are not provided by other people, at least not reliably so, because they disappoint us. They leave us. They abandon us. You know, they're not always there for us. And the ways in which we're dependent upon them, especially as infants are on the mother or caregiver, also sort of may offer us a reality, but it's a reality of dependence. It's not the one to which we aspire. It's the appropriate one at an early age, but, you know, we need to move on from that into a relationship of equality with others. And we cannot do that just by relating to others who are, as I said, unreliable in some ways. We need to have objects that provide the permanence that humans cannot always be counted upon to provide.
Right,
and they're just like a necessary part of the story. It's not like one or the other, but, you know, he calls attention to the important role that objects play in mediating the relationship with others that Hegel correctly sees as part of our identity through reflection and interaction.
Right, you also talk about Hannah Arendt and her view of work the moment in the human condition where she discusses these objects that have a kind of permanence that form the collective space, the table is her famous example around which we can discuss and perform actions. So maybe you can say a little bit about Arendt's view of work on your view and how you think it's important to your theory.
Sure. So I think one of the things that I was excited about in writing this book is that I was reconsidering my own earlier views of Arendt's work, and also I think some of the dominant views of her work in the literature and political theory, by which I mean that she has a book, The Human Condition, in which she talks about the active life and its three registers. One is labor, one is work, and the third is action. And most people, including myself in an earlier iteration, see her as being, you know, fairly dismissive of labor and work and really wanting to promote action, which is the domain of political action, as the domain of self-realization. And, you know, it's thrilling. Action is thrilling. Labor is kind of drudgy. It's where we change the diapers and make the food and wash the dishes and grow the corn. And work is somewhere in between, but still not quite as, thrillingly self-fulfilling as action. And work is where we, you know, build things like tables and chairs and so on, houses and so on. So a lot of people in an earlier kind of moment of receiving Arendt's work would really focus a lot on that action chapter in political theory and not pay so much attention to labor and work. The few people who did pay attention to labor and work suggested especially that labor was, the way that she treated labor was a sign of her own kind of misogyny, because labor is obviously to them the domain of women's work. The housework, the repetition, the circularity of the toiling on behalf of natural life and its reproduction, and that it seems to have occupied the lowest order for Arendt. And, you know, it's kind of a reading of her as if she was Hegel, actually, as if it was a progressive move to get to action, mm-hmm. rather than there being just these three equal domains in the sense of all of them constitute part of human living. So one of the things that I found was made possible for me by reading her together with Winnicott, which I did partly because she, too, is interested in our relations to objects, object relations, is that there were elements of his account that really opened up possibilities in her account that I simply had not seen before. And these are two. One is everything I just said before about transitional objects and object relations in Winnicott relies on the existence of what he calls a holding environment. And it's the job of the caregiver to provide the child with a holding environment, which is to say some kind of bounded psychic or geographic or architectural space that makes tolerable all of the kind of infinitudes that the child experiences before it comes to understand itself as having its own boundaries. The holding environment is very important part of being able to have object relations in Winnicott. Well, it turns out that in Hannah Arendt's work, if you pay attention to where she talks about objects and to something that is the equivalent of the holding environment, it all happens in the work section of the human condition. And once you look at the work section of the human condition as the spine of the book, and then you see the extent to which it isn't that labor is all bad and action is all good, although, you know, there are arguments to be had there. But you can see how labor and action are so similar to each other. Neither one of them creates anything of lasting permanence. Action, you know, when you give a great speech or start a movement, it spirals in unexpected and contingent directions. It's completely unpredictable how it will go, and sometimes it's self-consuming and, like, you know, it all just disappears, and sometimes it is a lasting story, and sometimes there's a monument, but sometimes not. And sometimes you might lose rather than win. So it's completely unpredictable and unexpected. But it's also very process-oriented in the sense that it opens up a series of possibilities that wouldn't have existed before if you didn't act. Similarly, in labor, even though there everything is very predictable and determined, each thing that happens is processoral in some way, and also results in a kind of, although predictable, impermanence. So everything decays. And in action, things may or may not be remembered, and that's part of what it means to be a political actor. So in between those two is something that's different from both, which is the place in which we erect permanence and lend permanence to a world that without work would lack it. Action alone doesn't create its own monuments. Action creates a story, and then it might be remembered through a statue, through a monument, through a declaration of independence, a piece of writing. But those things happen by way of work. Similarly, labor doesn't create, you know, monuments to its own processes. They have to be interrupted by the process of work. And so from the perspective of work, you can suddenly see how labor and action both suffer from an incapacity to create, to interrupt them, their processes and create their own permanence. They have a kind of mirroring quality to them. Work is the place of the holding environment where objects with relative permanence are created, and in relationship to them, we labor and we act. And so it becomes sort of reading Arendt with Winnicott creates a whole new orientation towards the human condition that I myself had not seen before and that I didn't see elsewhere in the literature. And I thought was really important because I also think that it's important that she and Winnicott, and this is something else I saw as a result of this new reading, both of them are writing in the context of a background is the Second World War. Winnicott in, you know, suffering along with everyone else with the bombing of London, and Arendt herself a refugee eventually from Germany. And both of them are very aware of what senses of dispersion and discollection and suffering occur when the relative permanences of your life are withdrawn from you. When a city is destroyed, when instead of seeing pairs of shoes in a window, you see piles of shoes in a concentration camp, that the conditions of human existence involve the legitimate expectation that the world as it is today will be there tomorrow. And both of them develop the importance of that normative perspective from their experience with catastrophe, with world destruction.
Right. Yeah, it often struck me that this is, to be, I guess, crude about it, that the Arendt section on work is more of the conservative moment, whereas the action part is more of the progressive moment. That is, if you think about work and the creation of a kind of world and then the transmission of that common world from generation to generation to generation as a kind of traditional inheritance, one might say, whereas action is that moment of, you know, sort of revolutionary upheaval, the constant transformation from generation to generation. And I mean, I found this very interesting in applying it to your view that, you know, the idea that a people can be constituted only through a sort of common set of objects that endure through time. I think we've been talking so far in the conversation about, you know, objects that you say are common in space, but it's also important to think, I guess with Arendt, that these things endure in time. She talks about, in this section work, about the immortality that's lent or the permanence that's lent through this. And, mm-hmm. and I mean, if we imagine, you know, this sort of constant upheaval of objects, it would render, I guess, the identity of the people very unstable, such that it would be difficult to sort of pick out what unify or individuate a people versus another, right?
Right. So I think, I can certainly see how you can find a conservative sounding politics in the work section. I think that's the payoff of thinking about her with Winnicott, though, is that a certain amount of stability and predictability is psychologically necessary and a lack of the trauma of rupture and abandonment are psychologically necessary. I'm thinking now of the children who've been separated from their families at the border of the U.S., the predictabilities of which they're being deprived, the continuity of relations with objects and people, and psychoanalysis objects includes people sometimes, are all terrible wrongs. They deprive you of the fundamental things that you need in order to develop in a healthy way. And so for Arendt, I'm not sure that what is important to her is the conservatism of conserving. But in fact, for Winnicott, that's a progressive, that's a necessary dimension of progressivism, that there is conserving. In other words, that there are certain things that have a kind of reliability to them that are conserved, and you know, that you don't wake up as a baby every day and they've moved the furniture in the middle of the night and you have to find your bearings all over again. you know, that every day you wake up and things are in the same place. You know, if you think of that childhood story, Good Night Moon, it's about everything being in its place in the room. And it is, if you read that with a child every night, you're recreating every night the experience of reliability and predictability through the story, through the book, but also through the child's own experience of its environment, which is a holding environment. So I would just, you know, I would think about the conserving not as politically conservative, but as a nod to the importance to human experience as a human experience of a certain conservingness, what in a different context we would call sustainability. And then I would also point out that one of her favorite examples elsewhere of a political action is a bit of a revolutionary action, but not all of her examples of action are revolutionary. Some of them are maintenance examples. Like, you know, if you have a well-functioning democracy, it's a question of political action to act every day in a way that maintains and defends it. Mm. So it's not always about change. It might be very much about conserving, but not in a necessarily conservative way. But one of her favorite examples is, of course, the American Declaration of Independence. And it's worth thinking about in connection with the idea of the holding environment, that the importance to her of the line in that document of "we hold these truths to be self-evident." So there, that's a kind of Winnicottian, unrecognized Winnicottian moment in her account, where what she really prizes about the Declaration is not just its contents of equality and audacity and, you know, hopefulness, but also the capacity of people to come together with each other and to hold together something that cannot be absent their holding it. That, you know, its only existence at that point is their resolve. And the fact that it comes through the language of holding, I think is quite striking. And it reminded me of elsewhere in her work, again, she talks about the Mayflower Compact, which is a kind of, you know, sneak preview into what will later be the We Hold and the Declaration, which is a mutual compact, you know, entered into by people about to, as she points out, importantly, about to get off the ship. But she says they make a compact before they get off the ship, you know. And why do they do that? Because they don't know what awaits them when they get off the ship. So on board ship, they enter into this compact, which becomes, in a way, again, she doesn't use this language, but it's helpful, a transitional object that enables them to face the unknown. You know, for them, the uncertain of what is awaiting them on the land. And to me, I think what's interesting, of course, is the ship also is said to have a hold. Later ships will have in that hold thousands, hundreds of thousands of enslaved peoples. But in that moment on the Mayflower Compact, which is a settler colonial moment, they enter into a we hold of a kind through the compact before they've left the holding environment of the ship. And that is, again, something that's well understood with the vocabulary that Winnicott provides without infantilizing or psychologizing people who were full-grown adults who were themselves refugees and had every reason to be attentive to the harms that they might do in turn to others upon landing. So I don't want to infantilize and make them irresponsible for actions that they go on to perform, but merely to suggest that the language shows how things that are easily, that were generated by observing infants in relationships to caregivers, that language turns out to be a useful language just for understanding certain kinds of political events and collectivities.
That's great. So I'm looking at the time. Time's running short. So I want to skip ahead to the third lecture, your third lecture, the last lecture in the book, and talk about Lars von Trier's film Melancholia, which you take up in this chapter alongside Jonathan Lear's Radical Hope. I wanted to focus on the film in part because I just watched it this week, even though it came out in 2012, was it, I think?
Yeah, even earlier, perhaps.
Okay, yeah.
The lectures. Maybe it was 2012. Yeah, the lectures were 13. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I missed it, although I've wanted to see it for a while because I like von Trier's work. But it was at least to me a deeply disturbing movie. I felt sick to my stomach after watching it. This, but I still thought it was good. So don't take this as a negative judgment. I had trouble sleeping. But anyway, in case I just to sketch the plot, because I will give some sense as to why it's so disturbing. It's split into two parts. The first part is called Justine, and it follows a wedding, Justine's wedding, who's played by Kirsten Dunst. And it's a sort of the kind of unraveling of that wedding as a result of Justine's melancholia that develops, her own depression that develops. And then the second part is about Claire, about her sister, and is about the approach of a planetary object to the Earth, which may or may not crash into the Earth and kill all life on the planet. And the sort of growing dread that it will and indeed does. And it's the film ends with the fiery destruction of the Earth. So it's a troubling movie, and you read it. I found your reading particularly interesting because it's a film, I think, that can be read in a number of different ways. You read it as a parable, you say, about democracy in disrepair. So maybe you could just sketch a little bit about, you know, so why, what about the film made you develop that interpretation?
Well, let me situate it this way. Now I'm not going to remember the great theorist who says this, but I know I quote him in the book, saying that it's easier for us to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And I think it's Eagleton, is it not, who says that?
But yeah, anyway, I think that's right.
The idea there is to say that we have all of these films in which the world somehow comes to an end, or these dystopic fantasies in literature and cinema, but why do we have those now? Why, you know, in this day and age are there so many of that genre? And his answer is that there's a kind of like death wish that is expressed through that genre, that is really about the way that we live under advanced capitalism, and that is kind of like the expression of the frustrated wish for something new, but people don't really see how to get to that something new, and so it ends up being expressed in a destructive rather than constructive fantasy. I find that a very provocative thought, in the sense that it provokes further thinking. The reading that I have in the Book of Melancholia is compatible with that, in the sense that I love the way you put it, that the first half of the film is about the unraveling of the wedding ritual. But you assigned it to her personal melancholia, and I think that her personal melancholia, which is very much assigned by the film the responsibility for the unraveling, is also shown to be symptomatic of other things that are going on at the time. Like, for me, one of the very powerful moments in the film is that her boss, she works in advertising, Justine does, and her boss is a guest at her wedding. And he has come along with an underling whom she does not know, some guy who's now working for the firm, has come to the wedding with the express purpose not to celebrate her marriage, but rather to extract one last tagline from her for a new advertising project before she leaves on her honeymoon. And so, you know, work is sort of ever present. The 24/7 temporality of work in neoliberalism is displayed in his demand that she provide him with one last bit of labor before she goes. And she's non-compliant, but it's less about whether he gets what he wants or whether the underling manages to extract value from her than it is about the fact that arguably that this is what triggers in her the melancholic response. It's not that she's never been melancholic before, but it's also not that the world has not been a world that triggers melancholy in us.
Yeah.
So it just kind of opens up a way of thinking about a mental, what we think of as a mental illness, as really an expression of a larger cultural and social and political anxiety, which we can analyze in a different kind of a way.
Yeah, that seems right? It seems absolutely right. I mean, one of the other features of the first half of the film is every character, it seems, is hell-bent on making Justine happy, right? The word happiness appears over and over and over again. And it's a sort of reflection of the obsession with happiness of a kind of bourgeois culture and a sort of forced emphasis on it. And the way in which too much zeroing in on the emphasis on happiness can be its own undoing. And there's a kind of implicit threat that stands behind this sort of be happy or else. The brother-in-law is an interesting character who owns the extremely palatial golf course and building where the wedding is taking place, and says essentially, you better how much this cost me. You better be happy or else, he kicks the mother of the sisters out of the building at one point. So there's a kind of, mm-hmm. I think that's definitely emphasized throughout the film, the way in which a sort of bourgeois capitalist culture that it can create its own self-destruction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the idea of the forced emphasis, as you put it, is actually also an emphasis on forcing happiness, as you're suggesting. So there's none of the awareness that you get even from utilitarians like Bentham and Mill, that happiness is a self-deferring quality and you can't go after it directly.
Mm-hmm.
Not only can you not buy it, but if you actually pursue it, it doesn't arrive. You have to, as John Stuart Mill says quite clearly, you have to pursue other kinds of things which don't seem to be happy-making, like studying hard, in order to experience it in a kind of deferred and indirect way. So there's something about the instrumentalizations of bourgeois culture under capitalism that persuade us that if we spend enough money and stage it correctly and have all the people there in the band, you know, that the result that we have bought and paid for is that she should be smiling. And of course, she isn't.
Right.
But that's because she's, in a way, I think this is the suggestion of the film, more truthful in a way. She's in touch with forces, as women are throughout Greek tragedy. She's in touch with forces that are beyond this particular constellation of the political economy of the moment.
Yep.
You can see her communing with the moon and with nature in different scenes. You get a sense that her melancholia isn't an illness in the sense of an absence of happiness. It has its own positivity in the sense of it's a way of her being open to other forces and other powers.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's kind of the wisdom in depression. Just in general, as a sort of final thought about this film, do you take it as a kind of fatalistic film, a quietistic film? At the end, of course, the melancholia hits the earth, and there's no possibility of resistance. There's this final scene, which you talk about in your book, in which there's a kind of a ritual that Justine enacts.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, do you take it as quietistic, or is there hope at the end?
So I read the film together with Jonathan Lear's book on radical hope. And what I notice is that the way that Lear talks about radical hope, which I find really constructive and powerful, is to some extent, I think, also limited because it becomes an individual's trait. Like the capacity to carry radical hope is a property of certain individuals on his account. And it comes with the individual trait of courage. One of the things I find by contrast in Melancholia, which does look like it might be quite resigned, to our you know, submission to powers beyond our control, is that it doesn't put all of the emphasis of hopefulness on a single individual. Instead, it constellates a family of sorts. It's two sisters and a child who are holding hands in a holding environment that the one aunt, the other is the mother, and the child have just built together in play. These are Winnicottian terms that are important in providing psychological permanence and stability so that we can move on to the next stage and the next stage. Importantly, Winnicott says that when the adolescent, when the child is an adolescent and acting out in all kinds of age-appropriate ways at that stage, that the parents will think that they have sowed a baby and reaped a bomb. This beautiful child that they've had for all these years is suddenly turned into this explosive nuclear device that seems capable only of catastrophic behavior and nothing positive. To my eyes, when I see that final scene in the film, I don't think it's literally saying, here's the destruction of the world. I think it's a kind of Winnicottian parable in which one of the adults, and only one, and she's the one who's in touch with her feelings, the melancholic Justine, is able, in the face of an impending catastrophe, which is real, you know, for the purposes of the narration of the film, to enter into play with the child and to be sort of the holding environment, providing mother figure for him. In play, they create this thing that he calls a magic cave, which is a teepee-like structure made out of twigs. And then they sit within its porous confines to face catastrophe together, holding hands, she, her sister, and the child. And in that hand-holding, we have, of course, an enactment of the holding environment. What we also have, because we see the child's age approaching adolescence, and we have Winnicott's voice in our heads, is an awareness that passing from one stage to the next can feel world-ending. So we may not be able to imagine the end of capitalism or accelerationism or extractivism, but in order to get through it to whatever's coming next, which will feel world-ending before it feels like we've entered into something new, we'll need to be in play, in action, in concert, building holding environments, holding hands. And so this is what I see as the really hopeful ending of Melancholia, in spite of the fact that it sort of also makes my stomach churn when I watch it, because it does actually depict the end of the world, which Peter Gendy, my colleague at Brown, says is the only film to do so, that all other films of catastrophe usually end with one voice giving the voiceover of what just happened, implying a survivor. But von Trier doesn't offer us that. But in not offering us that, he's truer to the psychic and political experience of entering into an abyss without knowing what's on the other side. In a way, those three in that teepee-like structure are holding hands in a way like the We Hold, like the Mayflower Compact, the, you know, the kind of being together to face something that is unfaceable and unthinkable, but that might produce something new and better. And there's no guarantee.
Yeah, that's great. Did you have any idea about why he uses Tristan and Isolde, the Wagner overture for that?
That's the one part of the project that I never got to fulfill, and I hope someone will, is to think about his choices, both of film references and musical references throughout. Do you have some thoughts?
Well, Tristan und Isolde is one of Wagner's most Schopenhauerian, you know, it's mm-hmm. after he's obsessed with Schopenhauer, he writes Tristan and Isolde. And there is a Schopenhauerian element to the film. Justine says at one point, the earth is evil and no one will miss mm-hmm. us when we're gone. But in any case, yeah, I was struck from the very beginning. Oh, okay, this is Tristan and Isolde. Okay, I don't know what to expect out of this, but...
Right. So, you know, one of the reasons I didn't get into it a lot for the purposes of this book is because once you get into it, there's a lot to say. So I yeah. would say, just in response to that, that I almost want to argue that that's a bit of a MacGuffin, as Hitchcock used to call his false leads or false clues in his films, right? Because you could give a Schopenhauerian reading of the film and you would end up with some kind of pessimism. But I'm not sure. I think that invitation is there, and at the same time, there are many cross currents, most especially all of the holding and the staging of the gender politics of the kinship environment and its reiterable qualities. In other words, all the things that seem like they should be predetermined, foretold, foreclosed by structure are recreated a little. You know, mm-hmm. and as I said, with Winnicott's help, you can see how the catastrophe of world endingness is part of exiting every stage of life, where you're just like, oh my God, what's now? What does it mean to, you know, there are all these books now on adulting, right? Why? Because what does it mean to be an adult coming out of adolescence? Or what does it mean to go into your 30s or 60s or retirement or enter an old age home or whatever? You know, like each of those feels, you know, to sell the home where you raised your children, each of those feels world ending in some way. And what comes next is, you know, unknown. And those are just individual psychological episodes that would be familiar to people, which is why I mention them. But they're only analogs to what goes on, you know, at a cultural or national or political level when a way of life that has been embraced is reaching its end. And the paradigm maybe is about to give way and something new is going to come. And you don't know if it's going to be, you know, the resurgence of Nazism, or is it going to be like some unthinkable possibility like socialism? And so there's a lot of anxiety and warranted, and it requires a lot of courage and hope to get through those moments, but it also requires not just those individual traits, but the holding that we see depicted in von Trier's film and the holding environment that can be quite fragile. It's just made of sticks. But it withstands, perhaps symbolically, is enough to withstand the onslaught as long as the hands are being held.
Yeah.
In other words, as long as we act in concert, as Arendt says we should.
Well, Bonnie, you've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much. And I really enjoyed the conversation. So let me end by saying thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
I really want to thank you very much. This has been fantastic, actually very helpful to my thinking, and I hope helpful to your listeners as well. So thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Association for Political Theory for promoting the show. And thanks to you for listening.